Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
From the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network for movie talk, this is Historic Hollywood, spotlighting the most influential and founding members of Hollywood.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Historic Hollywood, a celebration of the cinema of yesteryear and the people who made it. As always, you can follow the network online, youtube.com/popcorntalknetwork, or on Twitter, @ThePopcornTalk. I am Lex Michael, all over social media, @TheLexMichael, and with me, as always, are...
Byron Lee Thompson, @ByronLee.
Carrie Bible, @FilmRadar.
So, today we are going to be talking about Rita Hayworth, but before we jump into our discussion, I know, Carrie, before we went on mic, you mentioned wanting to make a couple corrections from our last show.
I did. Okay, first off, when I see Rita, I kind of lose my head. I'm clearly not the first person to feel this way, so I forgot a few things last week, and I made a few mistakes, so I do want to address that.
Do you mean when we were doing our watch-along for
we
Gilda?
We were doing our watch-along, yes. Actually, Charles Vider, who directed Gilda, which we watched last week, he directed three movies with her, Cover Girl in 1943, Gilda in 46, and The Loves of Carmen in 1948. So Affair in Trinidad was not directed by him, which I think I said. It was actually directed by Vincent Sherman, so I got those two movies confused. My bad. And also, Rudolph Matej, who shot Gilda, which we were talking so much about the cinematography of Gilda that I forgot my notes on Matej and just spaced on it. Again, I see Rita, lose my head.
Sure.
Understandably so, but I do want to just say a few quick things about him.
Okay.
Because we just gushed so much about the cinematography of Gilda. So he shot The Passion of Joan of Arc, the silent film in 1928, Carl Theodor Dreyer. He shot Prix de Beauté with Louise Brooks. He shot films with Carol Lombard, Marlene Dietrich, Barbara Stanwyck. Tons of incredible credits as a cinematographer. For Rita, he shot multiple movies, including Cover Girl and Down to Earth, did some uncredited work on Lady from Shanghai, and of course Gilda, and Tonight and Every Night. So, great cinematographer, and it really, of course, contributes to the Hayworth on-screen magnificence.
Yeah, absolutely. Is that going to do it for your corrections?
Yeah, it is. It is. Okay. I'm ready to go.
No, great. So yeah, let's jump into our conversation. And I don't know about you guys, and I touched on this a little bit before we came into the studio. In the reading that I was doing about Rita Hayworth, a lot of what stuck out to me were details of her personal life that I feel, much in the way that I felt doing research for our discussion on Marilyn Monroe, I feel like most people, especially younger people now, people around my age, if they know Rita Hayworth at all, they know the icon Rita Hayworth more than they know her work or more than they know Rita Hayworth, the woman. So being that I was very much the same way, learning a lot of information about who she was and how there was so much more to her than this iconic image, you know, the image that people have of her as, say, Gilda, for example.
Yeah,
and so much of it, much like a Marilyn Monroe, so much of it was tragic. So much of it was dark, was unpleasant, yikes. So I wanted to just jump in at the beginning, and then we can jump around a little bit. But I think there are some things early on in her story that certainly inform a lot of what comes later, specifically as applies to her relationship with her father, which we, the three of us, have talked a little bit about off mic. But she was born October 17th, 1918, and she was born Margarita Carmen Cancino. And both of her parents were entertainers. Her father, Eduardo, was a dancer, dance instructor. Her mother, whose name I have here,
Volga.
Thank you, Volga Hayworth.
Hallworth. It was Hallworth, and they added
They added the Y when Rita would eventually change her name. But she was a Ziegfeld girl. She performed with the Ziegfeld Follies, which is how would you describe the Ziegfeld Follies for somebody like little children like myself who may not necessarily be as familiar?
The greatest dancing you've ever seen.
Sure.
By far. That's like the goal, to be a Ziegfeld girl.
Yeah, the way it was described when I was doing some reading on it is it's a combination of later Broadway shows and then also these vaudevillian variety shows that you would see these, you know, like during the Depression, vaudeville became fairly popular. A combination of the two. And Rita, from a very, very young age, was trained by her father as a dancer. And it seems, by all accounts, like she really took to it. Now, eventually being when she was, I want to say, correct me if you, either of you know different, when she was about 12, they brought her to Hollywood and tried to get her in front of cameras. And while that was going on, her father was operating a dance school. But I believe during the Depression, the dance school fell apart. They had no real way to support themselves. And so her father put this act together, the Dancing Cancinos. It was him and his daughter, young Rita, or Margarita at the time. And they took this act to Mexico because Mexico, for example, had more lax regulations as applies to minors working, for example. But the story that I heard was that they weren't sold to their audiences as father and daughter. They were sold as husband and wife, which already is, to me, a little creepy. And then you start to read a little bit further and you start to hear these stories about, well, it's been discussed that in addition to the act being sold as a husband and wife act, behind closed doors, when the show was over, Rita's father would maybe coerce her into performing, let's say, wifely duties.
Coerce?
Let's use the word coerce.
The only source I've ever heard that story from is from this book. And apparently Orson Welles told Barbara Lemming that her Rita's father would rape her and beat her and so forth. So, but that's the only source of that I've ever heard. So it's one of those things where, you know,
yeah,
it's,
I mean,
a complicated.
It's certainly not something that we can state definitively. Yes, this absolutely happened, but it has been discussed. Byron, you're making a face.
Well, no, we were talking about it outside. The thing that was, I thought, more creepy was because of Carrie opening my eyes to Rita Hayworth's career and all of her past, I realized, as we're talking about it, that she was a dancer first.
Yes.
And I saw this short film that came with the Gilda thing, The Columbia Girl, which is all about Rita. And I saw all these clips from the films that she did with Fred Astaire. And the creepy thing that I thought was Fred's audios on the piece talking about how, oh, I was so close with her father.
We,
sure, were really good friends. So it just seemed like a natural thing. And now to find out that maybe it wasn't the best of relationships, it all seems kind of, like you said, kind of creepy.
Yes, absolutely. And it does, whether or not there was the
right, because we're not saying that.
Right. Whether or not there was the sexual aspect to the relationship, there was certainly a dynamic there, and a controlling dynamic, a dynamic of not necessarily allowing Rita to be her own person, to have to live up to an image that was very tightly controlled by a man. That is something that we would see more than once in her story going forward, certainly as applies to her first marriage, and we can talk about that in a minute, a little bit. But there's a window of time where she's able to get screen tests and do a little bit of work at Fox, but nothing big, nothing major.
She was in Dante's Inferno with Spencer Tracy. She was just a dancer in that film and had a small part, I believe. And but in the early years, she had a very ethnic look, and so
yes,
that was what led to that early casting, I'm sure.
Yes, and I know when they were, you know, she had these bit parts in certain movies, and she would dance at clubs and things like that. And I know it was the name is here, Winfield Sheehan, who was the head of the Fox Film Corporation, was the one that saw her and brought her into the Fox fold temporarily. But yeah, as mentioned, there wasn't a ton of high profile work to be done. Eventually, Fox merged, became 20th Century Fox, and Daryl Zanuck took over. And when Sheehan was essentially, he was fired, I believe, her contract wasn't renewed. So she was back to essentially a no man's land. But I believe shortly thereafter was when the man who would become her first husband entered the picture. And it's another of these relationships that I mean, this one, I think her first marriage more than any of the others, although she was married 5 times, I believe, mm-hmm. and none of them went particularly well for very long. But I would say the first marriage especially most closely mirrors what, at least what I understand about the relationship dynamic with her father, and I don't know how much you guys know about that relationship.
Well, for a lot of these, I love reading up on people's backstories, especially in Hollywood, and I noticed that a lot of these people, their first marriage is predicated, if not on love, predicated on I have to get away from a controlling mom or dad.
Sure.
And you see that pattern a lot with people like Judy Garland, with other women as well. Just I got to get away from an overbearing, controlling parental figure, and this getting married is my way of doing that.
Yes.
And Eddie Judson was basically, I believe, a used car or a car salesman. And he kind of was a man about town and really forceful, really kind of a driving force in Rita's early career. They lived in a home with absolutely no furniture because every penny of the money he made was promoting Rita's career.
Sure.
And he was a shameless self-promoter of Rita, but he would try to encourage her to sleep with Harry Cohn, which she would not do. And he was really, you know, trying to push her forward. And she endured a very, what they call a brutal Pygmalion transformation, because she had a widow's peak and black hair. And they did an electrolysis of about an inch on her forehead to raise her hairline.
Yes.
And, of course, changing her hair color and really sculpting her image. And Eddie Judson kind of saw her, I think, as an investment, not really as a partner.
Sure. And it's that. It's a combination of Judson, and then once you bring in Harry Cohn, then you have another man who then Cohn, especially for a large, almost the entirety of Rita Hayworth's career, tried to be that person then, tried to be that controlling image shaper. But yeah, it was the two of them, I think, working in concert with each other that led to this, I like the term a lot, the Pygmalion transformation.
Brutal Pygmalion transformation.
Yeah, it is interesting that for a while, as odd as the relationship was, if only in the sense that Judson was, I believe, in his 40s at the time.
Yeah, he was a lot older than Rita.
Considerably.
Yeah. He's very young.
And her parents, I objected strongly to this marriage, understandably. But it did seem like for a while anyway, the decisions that he was making and the directions he was pushing her in were legitimately beneficial for her career.
Career, yeah. Personal life, not so much.
Was
career, yeah.
Terrifying. And of course, later, you know, he helps her shape the career, but then he also begins helping himself to her money, mm-hmm. for example. But it is in this period that this relationship with, yes, with Harry Cohn, but in a broader sense with Columbia Pictures begins. And Columbia Pictures was her home, essentially, for the bulk of her career, to the point where, you know, you go cut away later. Like, for example, a movie like she did later on. She did Pal Joey with Frank Sinatra and Kim Novak. Got top billing over Sinatra. And it was, I believe, the only movie post, From Here to Eternity, that Sinatra didn't receive top billing for because at that point, Rita Hayworth was Columbia Pictures, for all intents and purposes.
How true this is, I don't know, but the rumor I had heard was that Sinatra was going to get top billing, and he said, no, give it to Rita. Now, that's definitely not in line with the typical Sinatra that we know.
Right.
But, I mean, you know.
But it's still, whether or not it was Sinatra who made that call, it does speak to the greater point of, by the time we get there, she was so an icon and so synonymous with the studio at which she was making movies. So she was working at Columbia Pictures, and she did a number of movies. It was a pretty lengthy filmography before we get to what I would say, what I think a lot of people would say, was her big coming out, which was Howard Hawks' Only Angels Have Wings.
All roads lead to Howard Hawks.
Which is great. It's great how many of these shows that we can intersect with Hawks' career. And there are a number of different stories about how that came about. The simplest and quickest version is mostly Harry Cohn pressured Hawks to cast her. I don't know exactly how true that is or what the dynamic there was. I know Hawks typically had a very, oh, you want me to do this? That's very nice. Okay. A type of relationship with a lot of the people that he worked for. But regardless of how it happened, Rita Hayworth got this part in that movie. And that I think was the first time that a mass audience really took notice. And how could you not?
Well, it's such a key part in the film because she's such a mysterious character in the film, and she's slowly, like Carrie had said it before, they don't have any good entrances anymore in movies.
Yes.
And her entrance in that film is phenomenal. She's clearly not the lead, but she's kind of like this mysterious person that kind of is revealed. So I think the Hawks thing, like all those stories you're talking about, I think it was because he really wanted maybe to pick his own person for that, and really that wasn't going to be the case.
Right.
But she's great in it.
And plus she holds the screen against Cary Grant. So, you know, not easy to do.
Absolutely. Especially considering that she was, and she had been working, but for somebody that had not, to my knowledge, worked on a production of that caliber, especially in a role, and it's not certainly not the biggest role in the movie, but it's a significant part. It was a significant step up for her as a performer. For all of those aspects to be as new for her as they were at the time, then it becomes even more impressive that, as you say, she was able to hold her own against a Cary Grant.
I want to point out, because again, I love going kind of under the radar with things, another breakthrough role for Rita that people never really talk about, but I think they should. It's worth it. Blood and Sand. They
yes.
remade the Valentino silent film with Tyrone Power in the early 40s at Fox, and Rita Good Hayworth point. Plays the vamp Donya Soul, a very early incarnation of Gilda, and she basically has a torrid romance with Tyrone Power and Anthony Quinn, and the movie is Tyrone Power, Linda Darnell, and it's in Technicolor. And
yes.
Rita is fantastic in that movie, and it is available on the swashbuckling box set of Tyrone Power movies. So worth checking out that one because it's kind of a lesser known Rita performance.
Good film. Really
yeah, and she
film.
Did that. She did that over at Fox, and it was around the same time, I believe, within a couple of years of doing Strawberry Blonde with Cagney as well.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And I believe Strawberry Blonde was also that followed Only Angels Have Wings and was. A fairly large success box office wise, and that again, it's like these factors taken in concert with each other really signaled the arrival of a really potentially very strong new talent. And of course, I'm sure Harry Cohn was very, very excited about this. Now, right after that, she goes back to Columbia, and then she makes her first of two movies with Fred Astaire, who Byron, you mentioned a few minutes ago. I didn't know until you brought it up that Fred Astaire apparently had this working relationship with her father, but it does make a bit of sense. When her father was running the dance school in Hollywood, there were a number of either current or eventual movie stars who came through the school. I do think it's interesting that, and something else we talked about before going on mic, obviously when you think Fred Astaire, most people associate him pretty directly and understandably with Ginger Rogers. And they made, the number escapes me at the moment, the number of movies that the two of them made together.
I think like 9 or 10 or a lot.
A lot.
A lot.
But when asked later who his favorite partner was, the name he gave wasn't Ginger Rogers, it was Rita Hayworth. And I think that's fascinating because they made two movies together. It was You'll Never Be Rich and You've Never Been Lovelier.
You Were Never Lovelier.
You Were Never Lovelier.
I think that I'm sure Harry Cohn would have loved that partnership to continue, but I don't think Astaire wanted to be directly linked to another dance partner on film. I think he kind of wanted to go do, you know, other things. So
sure.
I think that was part of it. But I think somewhere she said that those two films were her favorite films in her career.
Yes, I don't have the quote in front of me, but I remember she later was quoted as saying, and I'll paraphrase the quote, but it's like, if there were jewels in my life, it was the movies I made with Fred Astaire. Now, shortly after that, you enter what I suppose could be considered her peak years at Columbia, and we're talking, you know, 44 to the end of the 40s. But in 44, she did CoverGirl. Now, see, like, Carrie, your reaction. Okay, so do me a favor, Carrie, talk a little bit about CoverGirl, if you would.
I love CoverGirl. That's such a good movie. Written by Virginia Van Upp. And it's just Rita. I love Rita in black and white, but I also love Rita in Technicolor.
Yes.
And she wears gorgeous gowns, and it's a musical. And again, not only Fred Astaire, but she holds her own against Gene Kelly,
yes.
both as an actress and on the dance floor. And it's just, it's a fun film. It's delightful. It's entertaining. And the Technicolor is gorgeous. And it's just a joy to watch CoverGirl. It's a great movie and a wonderful vehicle for Rita.
And it was, if I'm not mistaken, around this time that she begins her relationship with Orson Welles.
Yes. They married during filming of Cover Girl, actually.
So Orson Welles, to me, stands out amongst all of the major relationships in her life for a number of reasons. First and perhaps most obvious being he was Orson Welles, but also because he wasn't a man in the same mold as her father or as her first husband or Harry Cohn, in that he wasn't... I think Orson Welles had a certain reputation for being, you know, a very big personality and a very what often comes along with that is a certain domineering quality, but he wasn't that person. And he was also, I mean, this was after a couple of years after Citizen Kane. So even though, you know, with Kane, you have the whole, the release of Citizen Kane became a little bit of a mess because of Hearst getting super grumpy about it. And then his next couple of movies, you know, Magnificent Ambersons, there was the...
Super grumpy?
let's say super grumpy.
I would think it's a lot larger than that.
It's a lot bigger than super grumpy.
Oh, sure.
That's a whole other episode, though, honest.
At some point, we're going to do a show about Orson Welles, and we'll talk
It's going to take me 10 years to do the research on that, though. This is one of the most complicated people in the world.
Oh, sure.
In so many ways. But...
But I wanted to, if I could, just because, before moving on, the idea of the two of them as a couple, especially now, in hindsight, because they are obviously two of the biggest icons of their era, the idea, now the two of them seems almost a natural fit. At the time, and depending on, and I haven't read the books the way, Carrie, the way you certainly have, the dynamic for Rita at the time seemed obviously it was a drastic shift, but I think it was Welles essentially fell in love with her right by seeing the Life magazine.
Yeah, and he said, "I'm going to marry her."
Right,
and went back to America and pursued her doggedly. And I think at first she thought it was a joke, that he was just doing this as some sort of a cruel joke, and she would not return his call. She wouldn't have anything to do with him. And he just really persisted, and finally kind of wore down her resistance, and she agreed to go out with him.
And then once that happens, he gets to know her a little bit, and he discovers, so the story goes, that this persona, this love goddess persona, wasn't actually who she is. That was a construct, if you will, and who she actually was somebody much more reserved, much more shy, but that, you know, he said, I think more than once, that she had a sweetness to her, like a genuine sweetness that he really took to. And so they started seeing each other. I know they worked. There was the Mercury shows that Welles was doing with Joseph Cotten.
They
at
did
the
magic show, but then Harry Cohn prevented. He said Rita couldn't be in the magic show anymore because it was a violation of her contract or something to that effect. And Rita was very upset because she felt included and she was a part of something, and it's kind of devastating to her. And I think that's sort of a turning point. Maybe is when Orson Welles thought, you know, started thinking he was going to marry her. And they got married during the making of Cover Girl.
Yes, and they got, and I do think it was interesting, too, when she left the shows that they were doing together, she was replaced with, of all people, Marlena Dietrich, which I think is an interesting connection to somebody else who we maybe will talk about at some point in the future. But so they're married, and it was only, I believe, 2 years. If Cover Girl was 44, it was 2 years after the fact that Gilda happens. And the conversations that apparently both Welles and Hayworth were having, I imagine separately, but with each other at the time, it seemed like already we're getting to a point where Rita was tiring of being expected to be the love goddess in every movie. That she was considering, if not leaving Hollywood completely, certainly trying to step away from that persona. And I know at around the same time, I think Orson Welles was talking about being dissatisfied with Hollywood and talking about maybe going into politics. And I think it's interesting that at about the same time, they both make a decision that would seem, at least on its face, to be a total, like going in the entire other direction of what they had said that they were intending to do. In the case of Orson Welles, he goes and makes The Stranger, which I think for him was certainly a more commercial enterprise than maybe would have been expected of him at the time. And for Rita Hayworth, it was going and making Gilda, which maybe more than, and tell me if you disagree, I think maybe more than any other picture she ever made cemented that image that she said that she had already been trying to shake.
And she never would.
And so we did talk a good deal about Gilda on our watch along, which was last week. But there, you know, I still wanted to wade into it a little bit here in case people listening haven't caught up with our watch along yet. I think there's so much to unpack as far as the stamp that Gilda left on the public consciousness at large, but certainly on Rita's career.
Well, it's the first of her films with Glenn Ford.
Yes.
And I'm sure Carrie can second this, but when that film came out, the common perception was that they were a couple, which they both denied clearly over that time period. But it didn't hurt the other films because they did four movies together.
I can't remember how many. I know they did Affair in Trinidad, Loves of Carmen, Gilda. I'm trying to think. There might be
the
more,
Loves of Carmen's fantastic.
Can't think off the top of my head.
But Glenn Ford and her had such chemistry. It was just such a thing. It did seem like they were a couple because those films were also so successful.
Sure.
One of the things that came out of Gilda, because one of the things we talked a lot about Gilda, like Carrie said, was the style and all of that. But the real thing was their relationship. It was toxic, of course, but it was great.
Yes. You mean the fictional relationship that is the centerpiece of that movie?
Yes.
Yes.
The fictional relationship, correct.
Yes. Like, which relationship? Yeah. It was also around this time that there's the famous story about the atom bomb that was dropped, the test bombing at Bikini Atoll, where, as a nod to her bombshell iconic status, the bomb was nicknamed... Rita or Gilda? I forget the nickname, but the rumor was that they had actually attached an image of her likeness to the bomb.
And you said she was unhappy with that, right?
She was furious. She was so angry. She flew into a rage when she was told. And she actually wanted to hold a press conference and say how upset she was about that. And Harry Cohn said no, because he thought it would be very unpatriotic of Rita to be upset about that.
Plus publicity.
But
yeah.
That's the last thing in the world she would have wanted, or did want.
And speaking of Harry Cohn, something that came up while we were doing our watch-along of Gilda, there are a number of sequences in the movie where the character is singing. And we talked about only one of them is actually Rita Hayworth's singing voice.
I thought it was when she sings the soft version with the guitar of Put the Blame on Mame. I thought that was her singing her own voice, but... You guys are telling me that that's not the case?
Oh, no, I believe that it is, well, yes.
I saw a thing called The Columbia Girl. We were talking about it before you got here, and they said that she's not in it at all.
Really?
Now, one of the things that Carrie said that I thought was probably more true than this thing from The Columbia Girl is the, where she's singing to Uncle Pio.
Uncle Pio.
Uncle Pio.
Yeah.
I think that probably is her voice because it's an a cappella thing, and mm-hmm. And I think that it's something where it actually is her voice, but they made a big deal in the Columbia thing as she wanted to use her voice, and they said no because it won't match. But I think the a cappella thing might actually just be her because it's
she
so
said it was.
It's so under the thing, but it said on the documentary that it wasn't. So it's a dispute, I guess.
And this was there were a number of issues that arose between Rita Hayworth and Harry Cohn while she was working at Columbia. One of her points of contention was that she was never allowed to emerge as a singer. This was something that she wanted to pursue, and Harry Cohn essentially just went, "Nah, you don't need to do that. That's fine. Nah, don't worry about it." And there was a lot of that, and there was a lot of contentious back and forth between Rita and Harry Cohn. A number of times, I believe it was the script for Affair in Trinidad, when she received the script, she talked later about she received it and threw it across the room and just decided, I'm not going to do it.
Here's the thing, we're kind of skipping ahead a little bit, but when she'd made Affair in Trinidad, she was in the process of leaving, you know, Prince Ali Khan, her third husband. He spent her entire fortune.
Sure.
And so she is financially, it's sixes and sevens, basically. She's kind of crawling back to Hollywood and defeat because her third marriage is over. Her fortune is gone. She's got now two children to support. She doesn't have the same position to argue with Harry Cohn that she might have once had. So
sure.
She, as much as she may have hated the script for Affair in Trinidad, she really didn't have a lot of choices at that point. She was kind of backed into a corner.
Sure. So, okay, you're absolutely right that we were jumping a little bit. Let's go back slightly. The marriage between Rita Hayworth and Orson Welles begins to dissolve and then I believe fully dissolves shortly after they make The Lady from Shanghai together.
Yep.
And Wells made this choice to alter Rita Hayworth's aesthetic fairly drastically for the movie.
Yeah, cuts her hair short,
makes her blonde. Topaz blonde. And
so
apparently, there's a photo where you can see, like, the entire Hollywood, like, press corps photographing this event of Orson cutting Rita's hair. And apparently Harry Cohn was just furious over that, too. I'm
kind of guessing.
And she's in a bathing
suit. It's a very kind of sultry role.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it was shortly after that, I believe, that their marriage was effectively done. Now, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, their divorce had not been finalized before Prince Ali Khan enters the picture?
I think it had, actually. I think it had. I'd have to look up the book. But the thing is, too, from what I've read,
yes,
is that Rita wanted a family. She wanted a home life. She wanted a husband that was going to spend time with her and be with her. Orson was obsessed with work.
Right.
And he left her alone to campaign or work for Roosevelt and do all this political stuff while she was pregnant. I mean, I think he said himself, if I wasn't a person obsessed with work, I could have stayed with her.
Right.
And he was obsessed with work, and also he fooled around pretty much constantly, and that was an issue as well.
Yes.
And I think that he wasn't the husband and the father and the family man that Rita wanted. That's ultimately what she wanted, and she kind of seemed to get everything except that. She kept marrying the opposite of that.
Sure. So their marriage dissolves, and then Prince Ali Khan enters the picture, and she essentially abandons her contract, too. Like, she leaves Hollywood for a number of years.
There was a very famous Variety headline that said, from Cone to Can to Khan decanned, I think. So, yeah. We should talk about Lady of Shanghai first, though, before we jump into the Ali Khan thing, because that kind of came first.
Sure.
A little more. I think that's, to me, I think it's one of her great roles. And
I agree. Yep.
I think sometimes when you are a sex bomb, people don't take you seriously as an actress or as a person of depth, really. And at least certainly not back then. But Rita, I think she's fantastic in this movie.
Me too.
Absolutely.
And I think that Orson obviously is one of the great masters of cinema, and I think at the time the movie was panned, but I think even Rita said, you know, time will prove this was a great film, and you know it is, and she's just so good in it. And the Hall of Mirrors sequence, of course, is one of the most famous.
The story that I read, and I'll let Carrie correct me as we go along here, for Lady from Shanghai, is
yes,
that he owed a lot of money because obviously he was having problems raising money for other films. And I guess Harry Cohn or somebody that was one of the executives at Columbia had called him, and he was in New York at the time, and asked him if he had any ideas. And he had looked down and seen a paperback pulp that said The Lady from Shanghai. And he said, oh, well, I've been working on The Lady from Shanghai for quite some time, just off the top of his head. And they wanted to be involved with him, but obviously that's when he got involved with the film. But my understanding, and of course this is where I kind of turn over to Carrie, I'm under the impression that Rita wanted very much to work with Orson Welles in a film, even though that was not something on his radar at the time. So I feel like she was more of a pushing force in getting into the film. I don't think that was necessarily the plan at the time.
What the story that I heard was Orson was working with Mike Todd on Around the World in 80 Days, I think.
Right,
it was.
That's right.
And he needed money, and he called Harry Cohn, and Harry Cohn said, I'll loan you the money if you'll give me a film. And then, I don't know that the book was called Lady from Shanghai, but it was a pulp, some sort of pulp novel. He just looked at it, read the title, and Harry goes, okay, yeah. So he got his money that he needed, and Rita wanted to work with him. She wanted to be in the film. I don't think that was Orson's idea, but Rita, that's what she wanted. And at that time, her power was very great. So, you know, and Harry Cohn would have wanted Rita to have another movie, so
sure.
Especially. So that's how I think that wound up coming to be, is that Rita, she wanted the part.
But as we mentioned, a lot of the decisions that Wells ultimately made with how he was going to alter Rita's image, the way he was going to shoot her, because if the story that I heard is to be believed, he intentionally avoided shooting a good deal of close-ups, for example. And this, the combination of lack of immediate focus on Rita Hayworth and also obviously the drastic alteration of her trademark image certainly wouldn't have made Harry Cohn particularly happy. And I do remember there was an editor, and I forget the editor's name on Lady from Shanghai, escapes me at the moment, but eventually went to Harry Cohn and said, well, I can't cut this unless we have some reshoots. And so, like, a number of Wells movies wasn't his idea, but they ended up having to go and shuffle a lot of pieces around to end up with a finished product that the studio would put their stamp on.
It was over budget, too, so they were having problems all the time with it.
Sure. And so, as mentioned, it was, unless there's something specific else you want to touch on with this movie, because it is great, and I think if things go according to plan, we're going to be talking about it a bit more in the weeks to come. Orson Welles' career
he's on our schedule
as a whole, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
But specifically Lady from Shanghai, I believe the plan is we're going to do a watch-along for that in a few weeks. But shortly after that, their marriage dissolves, combination of a number of factors that we've touched upon. Prince Ali Khan enters the picture, and she departs for a handful of years. And I don't know a huge amount about their relationship other than, for me, I know a lot of the surface-level stuff about how, I mean, he was a Muslim prince. So she was, unless there's somebody that I missed, maybe the first Hollywood star to become, by marriage, became a princess.
I think so. I think so. Gloria Swanson married a marquis in the 20s. But, yeah, she wasn't a princess. I think Rita might have been the first to do that, yeah.
Yeah, and so she was out of films for, I believe, 3-4 years?
About 3, I think, total, I believe.
And do you know much information about what the two of them got up to in those intervening years?
Well, the thing is, their relationship was ridden with scandal. Because
sure.
When they met, Rita, I believe, was just ending her Orson Welles marriage, and Ali was still married.
Yes.
He was, even though he was a Muslim prince, he was a notorious womanizer. And I think he kind of saw women as trophies, really.
I mean,
because he would go on to have relationships with Yvonne DiCarlo, Jean Tierney. I mean, he just saw these women as prizes to claim, so to speak. And, of course, Rita was a sensation. This is hot off Gilda, Lady from Shanghai, all this. And they began a relationship. Well, he was still married. And they were basically gallivanting around the globe, and he's still a married man. And this became a huge scandal. And then Rita leaves her child with Orson Welles just for months on end when she's running off with this guy. And, you know, it was a big deal. It was a big, big scandal. And his father, the Aga, was furious about, read more about in the book, but anyway, furious about the whole thing because they're religious leaders and this is making them look very bad and so forth. And then Rita gets pregnant. So, you know, and at that time, I mean, today it's different, but in that time, if you got pregnant and you weren't married, you might as well be committing career suicide at that point. Seriously. And so, if people knew about it, anyway. So, Ali Khan got a divorce, and he and Rita Hayworth got married. She was 2 months pregnant when they got married, and 7 months later, Princess Yasmin Ali Khan was born. And there was a big deal about, oh, we have so many premature babies in our family. And that was kind of a big thing so that they could offset the fact that she was already pregnant when she married him. But it was just, it was a huge scandal. It was in the news like crazy. And they were only legally married or technically married and together 1 year. And then she fled after a year because, he womanized. He had parties constantly. Again, it's kind of the same pattern. She wanted a stable home life. She wanted normalcy, and she kept marrying people who provided the exact opposite of that.
Right.
And so she got fed up and sick of it and snuck out of Europe and back to America after 1 year.
Yeah, and when the divorce went through, it was in 1951, the grounds she cited, I have here, a quote, extreme cruelty, entirely mental in nature.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, there was a struggle between the two of them over money that would persist.
Well, she wanted a trust fund for Yasmin, and also he spent her fortune. I mean, even though he was a prince and of great wealth, he just spent her money like water and a lot of stars, they don't have a sense of money and how to deal with money. So, you know what I mean? And so she was in pretty bad financial shape when she came back to Hollywood.
And when she did come back after that marriage, that was when Affair in Trinidad happened,
yeah.
Yes?
Yeah, that was her return to Columbia.
With Glenn Ford.
Yes, with Glenn Ford again. And I believe that was also a very successful movie. I believe it did better box office than Gilda did.
But it's not a good one, really. And it's kind of a pale imitation of Gilda. It's kind of them going, well, if it worked in Gilda, let's make it work again. Sure. Which they still do today, of course, in Hollywood.
Excessively happens all the time. Yeah, that made money. This has got to make money. It's the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the same thing. They'll eat it up. And yeah, so that was the idea.
And that was 52, I believe.
I believe so, around that time. Yeah.
And so then we get into this period, I want to say 53 to about 57, where you don't see a ton of her on screen either because she's dealing with this disastrous relationship with Dick Haymes.
Dick Haymes was known as Mr. Evil. He was supposed to be... I'm not kidding you.
That's amazing.
There's actually a photo of him looking just like that in one of these books. He was kind of a rival crooner to Frank Sinatra, and he... really used Rita to avoid being deported back to South America.
That was where I think the initial bond was formed. I mean, I think they met, right, because he'd be singing at nightclubs and she would show up. And all of a sudden, the audience would exponentially grow in size because they were there to see Rita Hayworth. And then this issue of a potential deportation comes up. And then, he sees an opportunity to use her to retain his citizenship. But also, he's having a crazy amount of money issues of his own. I believe in July of 54, within about a week of each other, two of his ex-wives had bench warrants issued for his arrest because he wasn't paying alimony to one, child support to the other.
Long before the modern term, oh, that person's a train wreck, happened, Dick Haymes, you could call him a very, very early version of the train wreck. The guy was just a one-man disaster show. But I would like to kind of sidestep that for a minute if we can and just talk about some of Rita's films around the ones she did make.
Yes.
Around this time, because she really very desperately wanted to escape the bombshell image and be a serious actress. And there are some attempts at that. Sadie Thompson, if you've ever seen that version, which is on the that box set right over there. That's a really good movie, and it's interesting because I've seen the Gloria Swanson version in the 20s, the Joan Crawford version in the 30s. It's interesting to see kind of what Rita does with that role, and also to watch all the men's faces when she sings The Heat Is On.
Sure.
And it's a sweaty, tropical scene. It's just really a great sensual performance. Salome? Is that how you say it?
Salome, I believe.
Not a great movie, but she's, of course, great in it. And her Dance of the Seven Veils is really not to be missed. And then, Byron, do you want to talk about some of the later films, Separate Tables or Fire Down Below? And I feel bad because you haven't...
I'm not as familiar with Rita Hayworth, I guess, as you both are. I'm more familiar with Lady from Shanghai and Gilda, but that's pretty much the extent for me. I'm just kind of a fan on the sideline side.
Sure.
Well, Separate Tables and Fire Down Below, she really stretches a lot as a dramatic actress in those films. Which was her goal. I mean, she really kind of got very close to that goal. And unfortunately, personal problems continue to plague Rita. She, after the Dick Haymes debacle, which is no other way to describe that, she married again another producer, James Hill, who was seeking to use her. And that ended pretty briefly, too. And Rita was an alcoholic for a very long time and eventually would become diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease.
And it's interesting, too, because she had been afflicted by it for a number of years, but nobody knew that's what it was. Everybody assumed that when she would fly into these rages or when she would behave self-destructively or when she would lash out, that it was a direct result of her drinking. And certainly the drinking didn't help. But, I believe Yasmin talked later about when they finally got this diagnosis, there was almost a certain amount of relief that came along with it because, we know what
this is now.
There's
a name for it.
Yeah.
And
it's interesting, too, and this is something that I mentioned before we went on mic that I wanted to touch on. It's not that Alzheimer's wasn't known at that point. It was, I believe, 1906 was when they at first discovered it. But in the intervening years, it had largely been forgotten about. But when somebody as significant, as iconic as Rita Hayworth receives that diagnosis and that information becomes public, as unfortunate as that is, as tragic as that is, and as terrible a thing as it is for anyone to have to go through, the benefit publicly was that now more people were paying attention to this illness. There were more eyes on it. It was a known thing. It was something that enabled this knowledge that somebody like Rita Hayworth was dealing with it enabled, I think, a lot of other people who were struggling, and not just the people afflicted with it directly, but their loved ones as well, to identify what the problem was and to be able to seek out the help that they needed.
Yeah, that's true. And Yasmin, her daughter with Ali Khan, basically dropped what she was doing, took care of Rita, and dedicated the rest of her life to raising funds for Alzheimer's research. There's a Rita Hayworth ball every year. She's really a tireless advocate for fundraising for Alzheimer's. So she's really done a terrific service to her mother's memory.
Yeah, and it was in 1987 when Rita Hayworth passed away at the age of 68, of course, leaving behind not just an incredibly strong body of work. I think Gilda alone, I think, is a stronger singular statement than most performers ever have the opportunity to make in an entire career. But also, she always will be Rita Hayworth, the icon. And I think she earned it. I think she absolutely lived up to that image.
She didn't like it.
It's not who she was, and it's not who she felt herself to be. But by all accounts, she was every bit as big as that persona, even if the persona was slightly left or right of what her real persona was. So we're going to have to wrap it up pretty soon. We covered a lot in a relatively short amount of time. So before we start to wrap things up, I just wanted to ask, you know, any final thoughts, any other movies that she made that you wanted to touch on, any other specific plot points from her life that didn't get a mention that you feel merit one?
Well, just to quote Carrie, even though I was going to say it anyway, Lady from Shanghai to me is past its due. I think it's one of the greatest films ever made, not just one of the greatest Rita Hayworth films ever made, but like Carrie had said, it was kind of a dud when it came out, but I think it's aged much like Gilda, even though clearly not in the same class as the iconic status, like you said. But I think also to echo Carrie, you should see these films.
Absolutely.
These films are out there, and they're out there on iTunes. They're in all kinds of places. They're great films.
And Gilda's coming out on Blu-ray with a documentary by the great noir czar Eddie Muller.
Yes.
Lots of extras, and that is going to be a must for anybody that's a fan of noir and a fan of Rita.
I believe it actually, as of this recording, we are just January 20-something, if.
22nd.
Thank you. 22nd in 2016. I believe last week or this past week, the Criterion Collection put that Blu-ray out. And also, because we mentioned it, because it was her big coming out, I believe in April, I could be mistaken, I will double check on this, but I believe in April they're also putting out a new Blu-ray of Howard Hawks' Only Angels Have Wings. Check that out as well. If you can't make it to a theater, I think your next best option is picking up a Criterion Collection Blu-ray, because always knock it out of the park. Is that it? Any other additional thoughts that you guys wanted to throw out before we wrap?
No, good.
No, everybody's A-okay.
I'm a big fan. I think you should see her stuff, just like we talk about. You should see her films.
Absolutely.
And read about her, too, if you get the chance. There are a lot of good books here about Rita and a beautiful woman and a very, very complicated life.
Absolutely. So before we sign off, we have our next several shows plotted out. Wanted to know, Byron, if you would like to tease what we are doing next.
Well, a producer here by the name of Kevin suggested to us to do a John Cassavetes show, which that's going to be our next one. So we're going to do the watch along on Sunday, week from Sunday.
Yes, a week from this Sunday.
With Faces.
Yes.
And one of his most famous films. And then we'll do the subject of John Cassavetes the following Sunday.
Yes, and I am very much looking forward to that. And we have a number of great shows lined up for you following those as well.
Including Orson Welles,
absolutely.
Which we're going to have a guest for as
yes.
well. So.
Awesome.
Who's the guest?
Mr. Child. Is it David?
Oh, we're going to get Dave Child?
That's what I was told.
Oh, we're going to try and get Mr. Dave Child. Oh, Mr. Dave Child. I do a number of AfterBuzz panels with this guy. He's awesome. So, in the meantime, Byron, where can people find you on the internet?
At Byron Lee on Twitter and Byron Lee Thompson on YouTube and whatnot. So,
Carrie?
At Film Radar on Twitter.
Great. And I am Lex Michael, all over social media at The Lex Michael. Please subscribe to us, like us, rate us 5 stars, throw suggestions at us, people that you'd love to hear us talk about on the show.
Oh, yes. People have been making suggestions over shows that we're going to do, and that's what we're doing. So that is kind of like what you said, the next 5 shows. So if you have something you want us to do on Twitter or whatever, please let us know because we're doing it.
Yes. We would love to hear from you. We would love your input. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you next time on Historic Hollywood.
Producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network. We would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.